good afternoon. I'm going to actually ask DJ Wells if he could come up towards the front. DJ is actually with the UIC UHP program, which is the program that I evaluated in my research, and I want him to be able to answer any specific questions and to talk about the program in and of itself. You want to sit? So my research, again, is a longitudinal analysis of minority enrichment programs. And we know, just as my earlier colleagues had spoke about, the need or the increased need to look at improvements in diversity within our healthcare workforce. And that's really the center around this particular piece. And there are no financial relationships. Thank you. In terms of background, again, when we look at the demographics of where we're going, where we are, we recognize that many of our states, as spoken before, are already seeing huge shifts in their populations in terms of minority-majority. We also know that parity does lack when we look at patients and providers. Why is that so important? Well, right now, when we look at what medical schools are teaching and even in our hospital settings, there's a huge focus on cultural competency, but there's a big difference, a significant difference between cultural competency and what we call patient and provider concordance. Patient and provider concordance is where, when there are similar backgrounds among patients and providers, there's research that actually demonstrates or shows that there are improved outcomes. Why is that significant? Because, and I'll use myself as a rough example, you know, I went to my first trip to Europe. Obviously, I did a lot of studying up on Europeans. I went to Switzerland. I did a lot of research on the various languages that are spoken, et cetera, et cetera. But even in embodying myself in that atmosphere and in researching their health system, I still was not Swedish, and I still could not, although I could refer back to what history told me, my experiences didn't speak directly to their experiences, and so that's very significant when we start to talk about patients and providers. The other piece, and I'll speak directly from the perspective of as a healthcare consultant, Dr. Dixon talked about infant mortality in Florida. Well, I'd like to take it up to a national perspective. I also do a lot of advocating through CMS Office of Innovations on looking at patient quality and patient safety through the National Partnerships of Patients. And through that campaign, what I found is that AHRQ reports every year that our health disparities have not changed. So while we have made a significant stride since the 1999 Institute of Medicine report on medical errors in quality, so since 1999, there's been a huge push to improve quality within the United States and to improve patient safety. But yet, if you look at the reports that are provided every year by AHRQ, there has been no change. Zero change in health disparities in those same categories. So when we look at for those of you again who work in the hospital settings, hospital acquired conditions. Okay, when we began to stratify our data and look at those specific issues and look at medical errors, we actually see that there has been no change as it relates to its impact on minorities and the outcomes of minorities. So this research is very important. Minority health professions enrichment programs have demonstrated a positive impact on outcomes within our healthcare diversity. So it is important to look at how do we create a pipeline. And many of you also know these as being stated as pipeline programs, rather. Research has also identified that funding sources, and I don't think that this, again, is anything new, but as my colleagues had spoke up earlier, though the conversation was more on a state basis, but I can tell you that in this research, I also looked at things from a national perspective. And so in looking back over 60 years of minority health programs, the same that we see on a state level is the same that was going on nationally. Very cyclical, very up and down. Depends on who's in administration, whether or not there's a big push on minority health issues. And so what happens is that funding dries up, funding increases. Funding dries up, funding increases over the years, and there's no real consistency to how we go about our approach in improving our healthcare workforce. And so again, all leading to the concerns of how do we improve our healthcare workforce? How do we improve diversity within our healthcare workforce? Recognizing that the real investment from a financial standpoint in these types of programs has been very up and down. So how do you keep a consistent process going? In 2006, there was research that was done by Dr. Rupert Evans, and Dr. Evans's research actually looked at the UIC-UHP program, which is the, I should say UIC, it's the University of Illinois at Chicago, thank you, urban health program, as well as he looked at the CHAMPS program, which is also another minority enrichment program there in the Chicago area. And he did a comparative study which did show that minority health enrichment programs do offer indeed a value back in terms of improving our healthcare workforce. So just a little bit about the UIC program. The UHP program was actually created as out of a state mandate. So similar to what my colleagues had stated earlier, back in 1978, because of a real uproar within the community and a cry out for for this special lens at diversity as an issue, in particular within education as well as within healthcare. There was some legislature that was birthed, and out of that funding, so there's a line item within the state budget within the state of Illinois that actually helps to underwrite the program. There are program offices in each of the colleges as well as the College of Graduate Studies, and then it's also has graduated more than 5,000 ethnic minorities. How did I get to a 5 minute? Okay. So, Demra, I'm going to kind of save you to the end because I want you to talk what we found. Okay. So my study looked at two time frames. Why are these two time frames very significant? Because prior to the 2004, under the direction of Dr. Michael Toney, there hadn't been, it was this wayward culture, if you will, around about really making certain that we stuck to the mission of what the UHP program had been created around. And the UHP program was created to recruit, retain, and graduate, and they actually identify specific ethnicities, so African American, Latino, Hispanic individuals, and there's a third one. Native Americans, thank you. So they're very specific about the groups of individuals, of populations in which they want to produce. And then also, we know that there have been some significant changes from a federal standpoint. Okay, the nomination of our first African American president, so on and so forth. So there have been some significant changes between those two time frames. This was a mixed methods approach, again, using a cross-sectional design. And again, looking at the efficacy and the effectiveness of the program was a predominant research question. The hypotheses actually go back to the original study. So again, looking at whether or not we have a strong and viable program, looking at the characteristics that actually make up a strong and viable program. And then I did look at specifically funding, program design, external support of career development, and again, looking at the support and efficacy of the program. In doing so, and moving to, there were, in terms of the mixed methods, there were in-depth semi-structured interviews conducted as well as focus groups conducted. And what we found here, and the significance of what we found in the in-depth interviews, actually when we look at longevity of those in the UIC program, while there wasn't a huge spike and increase, it was really about the quality of the staff and the commitment of the staff. So that's a huge personnel note that we need to put in place. So it really wasn't about whether or not folks were around 20 or 30 years. It was really about the quality and the consistency of those individuals behind the table and their commitment to the mission. And then in terms of the focus group, similar to what I had heard earlier, we did have an issue with recruiting a pretty diverse panel of people into our focus groups, and not that, to your earlier statement, not that we we didn't try, but the honest truth was is that we predominantly were able to recruit African Americans. It was predominantly individuals who had been through a minority enrichment program, and then they were also predominantly female. I don't think that that surprised us much any. Obviously, the African-American and the female piece, you know, there's a real strong passion within those groups around these types of issues. When we looked at program measure of success, and I'm going to kind of skip ahead because I actually have the summary slides here, impact on funding. The first that we saw was is that when the institution got back to the core mission and vision of the UHP program and actually shifted its funding sources, so no more were there huge dollars coming from our national buckets, but there were internal investments from each of the colleges, and we see a huge spike as you move to the 2007 era moving forward. That's when you have your change in the culture, if you will, across the UIC enterprise. And then I'm going to just move forward here. Okay, here we go. So the longitudinal comparative. So when we look at enrollment, we do see a significant spike in enrollment. When we look at graduation, while we didn't see the same, it's thought that the rationale is that we would see, if we were to look at this one more year, just because of the cohorts and the length of time it takes to graduate, that beginning in that next year, we would see that same spike. When we looked at pre and post GPA as well as GRE, both significant in terms of the comparative year. And also, in this study, which was new, we looked at retention. There was a cross-tabulation report that was done looking at, for each college, at your point of entry and year over year. And what we found was is that retention was at 100%. Funding. Okay, we see that there was a 39% improvement in funding, but yet barrier is still identified significant as a barrier to success. I'm going to, okay, open it up for questions. And my apologies, I did not, my apologies. Are there questions about, yes.
So what we'd like to do is open it up. We have.
You sure you didn't cut me? No, I'm just playing.
All right.
Yes.
A few seconds over, but what we're going to do, we have like plenty of time, like 15 minutes, 20 minutes for Q&A. So,
all right.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can go on.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. So, the participants, I mean, you have an amazing retention at 100%.
Mm-hmm.
The participants, was it mostly African American? Were there any Latinos in that involved?
Oh, yeah. And you can probably talk more about the demographics today, the way it exists. But in that cohort, there was actually, it was all. Obviously minority, and within the ethnicities that I spoke of. So there was actually Asian was also represented, Latino was represented, African American and Native Americans.
Mm-hmm. Our student cohort going through all of the health science colleges at UIC is probably pretty close to 50-50 in terms. As far as the urban health program is concerned, we're probably about 50% African American, 50% Latino in the urban health program. You know, those are the students serviced by the urban health program. It varies from college to college. Our College of Applied Health Sciences is probably more predominantly African American. Our College of Medicine actually has recently shifted so that we actually have a larger Latino population. In terms of our participation in the urban health program. So it varies from college to college. There are six health science colleges at UIC, and urban health is a very strong presence in each of those colleges.
And the one other thing that I would add, in terms of retention, whether it was the semi-structured interviews, the focus groups, or even just, you know, anecdotal talking to individuals, what we found, and similar to what my colleagues talked about, is that piece around support was so critical. And I think the very interesting thing here, what I found in talking to individuals that had come through the UIC program in particular, and I spoke to physicians that are 20 and 30 years tenured that graduated from his program, and those individuals talked about the fact that that sense of support or community support still exists today. And so where there's this give, it's 360 because it continues even after graduation. And so that seemed to be the most critical piece, irrespective of where folks were throughout the journey.
Just go to the Urban Health Program website at the University of Illinois, which is uhp.uic.edu. And through that website, you can, I'm sorry?
That's if she had a contact slide.
I don't think that,
it's just my
data. Yeah.
uhp.uic.edu, and through that website, you can access people in all of the health science colleges or come straight through our office and be guided into whichever program you might be interested in. And one thing that Natasha's study didn't get into, at least not extensively, is the fact that Urban Health is a P through 20 pipeline program. And so we're working with students literally as early as preschool with enrichment activities, encouraging students to think about the health sciences in communities where they don't necessarily have doctors and dentists and pharmacists as role models, making them think that the health sciences are a viable option for them.
Now, the one thing to remember is that minority enrichment programs or these pipeline programs, they come in all shapes and sizes. So all of them are structured very differently. To DJ's point is that UIC does have a focus that branches out into the community. But one issue that I found, and this is just studying various minority enrichment programs, is that tracking of these individuals and these participants longitudinally throughout the years is an issue. And so that is something that we on the other side need to consider because we're certain that the numbers are probably much higher than what they are, but for whatever reason, the tracking has not been as good. There's a question here.
Anybody that has an MPH or PhD or DR PhD needs to be exposed to the real community.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes.
And I found that I did epidemiology over 10 years ago. I know nothing about health disparity.
Mm-hmm.
I know they tell me those numbers are up and down. I was always so curious about what's going on here. But so many years after I became an instructor and I began to read, and I said, really? I was so ignorant even with my doctoral degree. And I think most of the public health students and graduates, they're really not prepared to talk about health disparity and diversity and everything. No matter what, even if EP or
outsourcing
or infectious disease, all relates to disparity. And we're not really prepared with most of the curriculum put together in most of these universities. And that's it. It's a service to people that go out into the community and do work and learn later on, which sometimes.
That's one of the benefits, though, of our collaboration.
To the mic, it's actually recorded.
Oh.
So if you respond.
Oh. Okay. So that we're going to
come
up. Okay.
I know as far
what she said recorded?
Actually wasn't so much a question, it was an on-target comment.
Yes.
And that is that schools of public health, no matter what the track may be, epidemiology, biostats, or whatever the track may be, do not really give students real-world experience. And that certainly is one of the, why the USF Bethune-Cookman partnership grew is because we recognized, and it was early on recognized, that the Center for Health Equity rests right within the community. And it was so important that we develop programs that so that when students come through it, they really have a real sense of what it is to develop programs. So, for example, if I can just take, we had a Healthy Start program. And how important it is, we just thought, for example, we could just set this up and students would come and they would, because it's Bethune-Cookman, people would come. I mean, we're trusted in the community. We have the name of Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune. What we missed was an important step, and that step is that Healthy Start in our community was attached to the Department of Children and Families, and the thought was, I don't care who you are, if you come in and start to institute programs, you're going to take away our babies. So that this was just a part of the learning curve as we started to develop what would be learning experiences for our students. That's real world stuff. You know, that's the stuff, you know, of when it is when you're going to especially decide to work within communities, the kinds of hidden issues that you're talking about that are there that really impact whether your people are going to learn. And it also kind of shades also, it's important for what you've learned so that it opens your eyes to so that it serves as a model for what you're doing in the future.
That's one of our next steps. Fortunately, we are the community partner for an epidemiologist at the University of South Florida that just got a humongous grant from the National Institutes of Health, because to do those kinds of things take resources. And unfortunately, so much of what we do is research-oriented. So we are beginning to do that right now. In fact, we just began the initial part of what we need to do with some focus groups, and we're doing some surveys, and then we will actually move on to the health impact assessment, because there's some very interesting things going on. I got the opportunity to talk with some of the violence prevention people, because in the state of Florida, where we have a very strong stand your ground law, one of the things that we're finding is that African-American women who are pregnant say that they experience a different level of stress once they find they're having a boy. because there is a certain level of stress that they experience just because they know they're going to have to raise a black male in the state of Florida. So, yes, so we do know that we have to move in that direction. We now have some resources to be able to do that. Our head evaluator is a prolific writer, so you all should be seeing some journal articles very soon. But thank you for that question. I may make a comment. One of the things that I didn't get a chance to talk about is that we're using different approaches, not just the Undoing Racism workshop from the People's Institute, because that's one that focuses, it spends a great deal of time focusing on having people look at their personal attitudes and their personal responses. But we're also using work from organizations like the Applied Research Center up in New York, who puts their focus on communication and talks about sometimes when you talk about intentionality, am I racist or am I not, that you really don't accomplish the kinds of things that you want to accomplish, because people then will get you involved in arguments that cannot be won. And so their focus is on addressing behavior. And then, of course, you have organizations like the Center for Social Inclusion, and we're also using some of their work where they've done research in terms of, you know, the ways that you can talk, the ways that you can talk about racism and address issues so that people really are willing to move forward and to address some behaviors. Because we know, as you did say, the way that you talk about it, the way that it's framed, you know, also has a lot to do with all people's responses to it as far as stress is related. Let me just say the question about the People's Institute and whether we have a relationship with the People's Institute in Oakland. We have a relationship with the People's Institute office in New Orleans. You know, they're just in different locations. And so that's the staff that we've used, and we tell them what demographics we need in terms of what our community, you know, what our community demographics are like.
In terms of characteristics with regards to the personnel, I can say that the one that stood out the most, that was the most consistent, is the commitment piece. And when I say commitment, in talking to these individuals, doing interviews with them, one thing that really stood out, we're talking on-off hours. We're talking years after folks graduate. So when we talk commitment, it's not just about, you know, that 8-hour commitment or that 10-hour commitment. It's about, you know what, I had a class full of folks who I knew would be struggling year two of medical school, and this is what I did. And it was over and beyond, you know, the curriculum, over and beyond what the program requirements were. So that level of commitment, I think, is something that's very difficult to measure, but it's certainly something that bubbled to the top. The other piece is that sense of community piece. Sense of community really elevated to the top from an ethnic value standpoint. The other piece that is very important is that we are beginning to evolve into a more colorblind society, if you will. And so for those individuals that have this sense of community, there was this automatic relationship that they could draw in on. And so that is actually beginning to show up in some of the recruitment even efforts. So it's really about the sense of community, you know, that ethnic value piece. I value humanly as who you are, and then that level of commitment.
And if I can add to that, we find that because of that sense of community, that translates very directly to our students. The students come to UIC knowing that they are a part of a 35-year tradition of graduating minority healthcare providers, and that those providers are not only that those providers are expected to go back out into the community and serve, that the state legislature created the program specifically to create folks from the community to go back to the community and provide the resources that are needed. And so that becomes a part of our culture. And so it attracts people who have those values in the first place. And so we're able to hire folks who have the commitment that Natasha spoke of. And we're also able to attract students who have that same type of commitment. And it just kind of continues to perpetuate itself.
DJ just made a statement that I want to also add to. So the environment allows you to live in your unique space. So I'm an African-American woman, yet still blend in with the diverse value of being in an environment that shows you all others in their spaces. And that's something that I quite couldn't get my arms around in terms of being able to write the most articulate narrative about that. But I think that's something that's worth studying moving forward, because the culture, this by institutionalizing this sense of diversity, it allowed people to feel the value of being who I am, represent who you are, that's where that sense of community piece comes from, but yet thrive in an environment and have respect for all others and help to motivate and, you know, improve the outcomes of all others as well.
We have about time for maybe one or two more questions. I just want to say on that note, it reminded me of something I read today in one of my morning meditations. It was a quote that said, "I am rooted, yet I flow."
Yeah. Wow.
And I was like, wow, I love it. Yeah. I wish I would have wrote it.
I can say from my vantage point, you're absolutely correct about, you know, the need to be able to comfortably, I guess is the best way to put it, talk about racism. But I'm not so certain that it's all about racism, right? I believe that certain pieces of it, you don't know what you don't know. And so racism implies that I know and that it's deliberate, as opposed to not knowing. And so I think that we need to attempt to produce environments that allow us to very comfortably talk about these issues. And that's really where the circumstance lies. That, and again, I'm going to give an example from a hospital administrator administrator standpoint, getting hospitals nationally just to look at their race and ethnicity data and utilize it is a feat within itself. Oh, we're already doing that. Well, no, you're not. Oh, well, we already know that. Well, no, you're not. Show me in your data. And so, and that's where I'm moving with this whole colorblind piece, because it's like we don't want to talk about it. And so it's improving the environment so that we do forge forward, you know, opportunities for us to comfortably talk about racism.
As you talk about governmental and other institutions in terms of this notion of racism, again, one of the things that we are doing in addition to work with the official Undoing Racism workshop, which has people to really think about intentionality, we're also dealing with those pieces, like I said, like the wonderful work coming out of the Applied Research Center that says, you know what? Intentionality is not something we're going to deal with. I'm not going to stand here and argue with you about whether you're a racist or not, but we are going to have some discussions about the impact out in the society. And what we're doing is we're finding, as we're working with our mayor and some other folks, we have some key people in the legislature, we're finding that people really are more willing, as we say, to have those kinds of discussions, because none of us really want to be put on, put on blast, as the kids would say. There, and we live in a society now where mixed race folks what are we going to do here? And we said we're going to look at the behaviors, and like we said, not just from the personal point of view, but we talk about not only personal racism, which we spend so much time on, but we've got to talk about the way these things have been institutionalized. And so, you know, one of the things that I'd even say to my friends across, you know, race and ethnicity is that we all have to work together. We all have to work together to make an equitable and just society for everybody. And so that's why we move from talking about health disparities to talking about health equity, because we said, look, when you compare the best group to the worst group, the best group is not good. So we don't want anybody to be there either. We want everybody to be better. So when we start having those kind of conversations, people, you know, kind of seem to be more open, both personally and institutionally, to look at, let's make things more equitable, let's make things better, more just for everybody.
That's it. I just want to add, in terms of a resource, I am currently on a fellowship with the Directors of Health Promotion and Education. It's a health equity policy fellowship. And so we are doing trainings to look at the value system of our legislators. So the aspect of the fact of, you know, do they care about effectiveness? Do they care about liberty? Do they care about, do they actually care about equity? And then we address those policies in terms of coming to our training about health equity regarding their value. So the policies that they actually support, we come from their perspective. And then we talk about the history of their political system. And in that, we will talk about the injustice that has happened. But we don't always talk about the fact that this is racist. We don't always do that per se. We do hope that discussion will come out, but we do talk from the aspect of what have they supported in the past that will tell you what they value, and then have the discussion from there.
Excellent. As a moderator, I know we could, I really wish if I ruled the world, we would mic up this whole thing and we would just have a discussion, because I believe that dialogue is a good tool, a good strategy to address these issues, and that's just what's happening right here. So I invite you to please get cards from the presenters, give them your cards, and let's exchange information and make this happen. And let's give our great panel another round of applause.